Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on former President Barack Obama coming to the region to campaign for Indiana Democrats. Dozens of Porter County voters are asked to recast ballots after a polling place snafu. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with economist Larry DeBoer about school referendums on the ballot. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Indiana's critical U.S. Senate race will draw two presidents to the state within the coming days. The Indiana Democratic Party announced Wednesday former President Barack Obama will campaign for incumbent Senator Joe Donnelly and other Democrats Sunday in Gary. The rally will take place at the Genesis Center. Doors open at noon. President Donald Trump will make two campaign trips to Indiana, Friday in Indianapolis and Monday in Fort Wayne. That follows recent appearances by former Vice President Joe Biden campaigning for Donnelly and Donald Trump Jr. campaigning for Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun and others. No tickets will be available on site for the Donnelly-Obama rally. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Either 118 or 122 voters cast their ballots early this past Saturday morning in Portage. But because of a mistake by poll workers, those voters are being asked to vote again. If they don't, the original ballots will be considered provisional and counted only after Election Day results are in. The issue caused a raucous meeting of the Portage County Election Board Wednesday afternoon as Democrats and Republicans argued, sometimes shouted, over what should be done to make sure those votes count. The two sides even disagreed about how many votes were in question. Democratic board member J.J. Stankiewicz proposed a requirement that the ballots be initialed by both poll workers and allow the votes to count, saying the mistake was the county's. His proposal hit a brick wall. Instead, the board decided to follow the procedure adopted Monday during an emergency meeting, asking those voters who have been identified and contacted to return and cast new ballots. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A jury has acquitted a Hammond man who authorities say stole two dogs that belonged to a woman he formerly dated and killed them. The Times reports a jury on Wednesday cleared 25-year-old Anthony Priestess of two felony counts killing a domestic animal. Defense attorney Andy Kyrus told jurors authorities charged the wrong person. He downplayed the relationship connection, saying Priestess and the dog's owner hadn't dated since 2014. Authorities say the man entered the Crown Point woman's home on February 21st, when no one was home, stole her pugs Muxie and Marley and fatally beat them in adjacent Porter County. Porter Superior Court says Priestess remained behind bars with no bond on other pending charges in Porter County and a burglary case in Lake County. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Charges have been refiled against a Northwest Indiana woman accused of arranging the 2012 shooting death of a business associate. The Times reports Porter County Prosecutor Brian Gentle says charges of murder and conspiracy to commit murder were refiled against 48-year-old Charisse Major as a result of new evidence. She's jailed after being taken into custody Monday. Court records don't list a lawyer for Major in the new case. A judge granted dismissal of charges in 2017 after Gentle said investigators weren't able to establish enough evidence linking Major to the killing of 72-year-old Carl Griffith Sr. on November 1st, 2012. Dante Singletary of Gary was sentenced in February 2015 to 65 years in prison for Griffith's death. Major is accused of hiring Singletary to kill Griffith. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. United Steelworkers union negotiators with ArcelorMittal headed back to Pittsburgh on Wednesday with hopes of coming to terms with the global steel company on several outstanding issues. Pete Trinidad, president of USW Local 6787 in Chesterton and a member of the union negotiating team, is hopeful that the issues, the most significant of which is profit sharing, could be ironed out in the next few days. John Brett, president and CEO of ArcelorMittal USA, wrote in his most recent blog, dated October October 22nd that the company's present proposal included a four-year contract with wage increases of 4%, 3.5%, 3.5%, and 3% each year, respectively, and a lump sum payment of $4,000 following ratification, no changes to profit sharing, and no increases to health care premiums, deductibles, or out-of-pocket expenses for active members or retirees, among other issues. But the USW, in its latest memo, said, while progress has been made in contract talks with ArcelorMittal, there are still issues. There are more than 7,400 USW members employed at ArcelorMittal Mills in East Chicago's Indiana Harbor section and Burns Harbor. Contract negotiations began July 9th. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Porter County man has pleaded guilty to stealing metal alloy from ArcelorMittal property and transporting it over state lines to sell. According to a news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office, Robert Watkins, 32, was sentenced to 15 months in prison and ordered to pay $1.1 million to ArcelorMittal. The restitution was the total amount of money lost by the Integrated Steel and Mining Company through the thefts. Watkins pleaded guilty to three counts of interstate transportation of stolen property from three different instances where metal was stolen from ArcelorMittal. Between September 2013 and March 2014, Watkins and others stole a metal alloy called ferrocolombian from ArcelorMittal property and drove it over state lines into Pennsylvania and Ohio to make a profit. Two other men have been charged in the alleged theft, including Christopher Forster and Ryan Hendrickson. According to court documents, the two other men were also charged with allegedly transporting stolen property. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Valparaiso University say the college will shutter its financially struggling law school after nearly 140 years. School officials say students, faculty, and staff were informed Monday of Friday's decision by the school's board of directors to teach out the law school's remaining students and cease operations. School president Mark Heckler tells The Times that closing the school, quote, was the only viable option. He goes on to say school officials will meet with each of the remaining law students to review their options. The announcement of the planned closure comes weeks after Tennessee regulators rejected a plan to move the law school to Middle Tennessee State University. The law school was founded in 1879 on Valparaiso University's campus. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's U.S. Senate candidates addressed several issues in their final debate Tuesday. That includes immigration, government spending, and foreign policy. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the candidates kept circling back to the issue of health care.
It's a debate that's played out over the whole campaign. Democratic incumbent Joe Donnelly calls himself, quote, the final vote to save health care, and attacks Mike Braun for the Republicans' support of a lawsuit to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
If you have someone in your family with diabetes, with arthritis, with asthma, their coverage goes away if Mike's lawsuit is successful.
Braun leads on his experience building his company's health care plan.
I want to lower the cost of health care to where it is affordable, what the original bill was supposed to do. You're not going to get it out of people that have been there.
And libertarian Lucy Breton stands by a repeated theme.
Government does not work. And when government gets involved with things, it gets more expensive, less efficient.
The election is November 6th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith in Indianapolis.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana voters this year are asked to decide whether to amend Indiana's constitution with language that requires the legislature to pass balanced budgets. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports some experts say, pass or fail, the proposed amendment will have little practical impact.
The ballot question asks if the Constitution should require lawmakers pass a balanced budget unless at least two-thirds of both chambers suspend that requirement. Former Indiana Supreme Court Justice Frank Sullivan argues the state constitution, in effect, already has such a requirement. It currently bars the legislature from creating debt except to meet, quote, casual deficits.
We've had a balanced budget in Indiana since 1891. That is to say, the current constitution has worked quite well.
Sullivan says the proposed language adds unnecessary complexity. Some online posts also claim the amendment would allow lawmakers to raid state pensions to cover budget shortfalls. But they can already do that. Nothing in current law stops lawmakers from taking measures to prevent a shortfall. In fact, the amendment potentially makes it harder to raid pensions by requiring 2/3 votes in both houses to do so. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Monday evening, 1,000 community members gathered in Indianapolis for a memorial service for the 11 people killed at a Pittsburgh synagogue this weekend. Carter Barrett from member station WFYI reports that the shooting was a reminder of Indiana's lack of a hate crime legislation.
Nearly every speaker, both religious and political, warned of divisiveness. And Rabbi Dennis Sasso told the crowd to leave with a commitment not only to pray, but to take action.
Let us not ignore the proliferation of guns in our country and the lack of a hate crimes law in our state.
Indiana is one of 5 states without hate crime legislation. But after a Carmel, Indiana synagogue was vandalized this summer, Governor Eric Holcomb has called for a hate crime law. When Vice President Mike Pence was governor, he opposed such legislation. Local professor Jeremy Price spoke about his personal connection to several of the victims, but ended his speech on a call for action.
Standing with a broad coalition of communities, we must vote.
For WFYI, I'm Carter Barrett.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. 3 children died this week after a vehicle struck them as they crossed the street to board a school bus in Fulton County. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports situations like this are rare, but bus drivers in Indiana say vehicles passing them illegally is nothing new.
Drivers going both ways have to stop for school buses when the red lights are on and the stop sign arm is extended, unless there's a barrier or median dividing the road. National Safety Council President Deborah Hirschman says sharing information about and enforcing those rules is vital.
We know that good laws, good education, and good enforcement can change behavior on our roadways.
Overall, school bus-related deaths are rare. In 2016, the council counted only 119 of them nationwide, but responses from schools on a voluntary Department of Education survey revealed this year more than 3,000 Hoosier drivers illegally passed a school bus in one day. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A longtime Indiana University law professor and his wife are suing the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department over a traffic stop that happened in 2016. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright reports, the professor says the officer involved violated several of the couple's constitutional rights.
The traffic stop occurred as Professor Kevin Brown and his wife were traveling home from Ohio. Court documents indicate Officer Emily Perkins pulled them over for several alleged traffic violations, but Brown waited to stop until he felt it was safe. Brown says Perkins approached the vehicle agitated, yelling at the couple, and with what Brown says appeared to be a drawn weapon. Officers ultimately arrested him. Court documents claim they never told Brown why he was being arrested or read him his rights.
If this police officer thinks she can do this to me, as the black professor of some 30 years down here in Bloomington who teaches criminal law, then she's going to think she can do this to anyone.
Perkins filed a probable cause affidavit following the traffic stop, which, according to court documents, contradicts many of Brown's claims. IMPD declined to comment on the pending litigation. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
The incident led to several criminal charges against Brown. All were dropped, but Brown pleaded guilty to changing lanes without a turn signal. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The individual marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, opened Thursday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that even though there have been some changes to the federal program, Hoosiers who need health insurance will have options.
Indiana residents can find comprehensive health insurance that is protected by provisions through the ACA and covers pre-existing conditions, maternity care, and mental health. This will be the first open enrollment after federal moves got rid of the individual mandate fee for not having insurance. In recent years, the Trump administration has also cut back the enrollment period and people hired to help enrollees.
Some federal funding went away, but in the state, we've actually had an expansion in the amount of navigators that we have available for a lot of consumers.
Mark Fairchild, policy director with Covering Kids and Families of Indiana, says his organization will offer support in 92 counties. People in Indiana will have two insurance companies with a variety of plans to choose from. Most qualify for federal subsidies through the ACA. About 160,000 people are enrolled in the individual marketplace in Indiana. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's smoking rate is among the highest in the nation. More than 21% of Hoosiers smoke, and that rate has remained stagnant in recent years. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports a new analysis digs into why the rates remain high.
More than 12,500 people in Indiana died last year from tobacco-related diseases, according to a new report from the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation. Indiana has higher rates of African Americans, pregnant mothers, and members of the LGBT community who smoke. The new report outlines tobacco as Indiana's greatest public health challenge. President and CEO of the Fairbanks Foundation, Claire Fidian Green, says the report is also meant as a call to action for lawmakers in particular.
And it turns out that for addressing the tobacco epidemic, the policy levers are really the most impactful.
In recent years, Indiana legislators have voted not to raise the cigarette tax. The report finds that if the state did raise the tax by $2, more than 70,000 Hoosiers would quit and save nearly $79 million in health care costs in the first 5 years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. FDA recently approved a new treatment for people who have a rare blood disorder. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-O'Donnell reports patients will have an easier time managing their condition.
For the last 20 years, patients with hemophilia A have had to inject a clotting assistant directly into a vein. But the new treatment, called Hemlibra, allows doctors to place a clotting aid underneath the skin. Dr. Amy Shapiro is the CEO of the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center. The center participated in a clinical trial for the new drug. Shapiro says this new method is transformative.
Think about kids growing up, learning to walk, falling, parents running behind them, worrying about whether they're going to get injured, whether they're going to bleed.
The FDA approved the new treatment after 15 years of research and development. It's only available for those with hemophilia A, which is the most common type of the disorder. Shapiro says up to 450 patients in the state could benefit from the new treatment. I'm Araceli Gomez-Saldana for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Conservation groups say the U.S. is illegally destroying wildlife habitat to produce biofuels. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, that has big implications for Indiana, where about 40% of our corn is grown for ethanol.
A federal law only allows land farmed before 2007 to grow corn and soybeans for biofuels. 13 organizations recently filed a petition urging the Environmental Protection Agency to enforce that law. A report from the agency shows cropland in the U.S. has increased by more than 4 million acres since 2007, including more than 50,000 in Indiana. Though the EPA isn't sure how much of that can be attributed to biofuels, Tim Maloney with the Hoosier Environmental Council says there are now 19 biofuel refineries in Indiana.
So that's adding pressure to our farmers to produce the feedstocks for those facilities.
But the National Corn Growers Association disagrees with the EPA's numbers. It says though more land is used to grow corn and soy, cropland overall hasn't gone up. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Indiana Supreme Court has ruled local governments can no longer fine railroad companies for stopping on tracks, regardless of how long a train may block a crossing. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle reports, business practices on both sides of the argument have become central to the conversation.
The state's highest court ruled a long-standing Indiana statute was regulating the railroad business. That's banned by a federal law, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, or ICTA. Solicitor General Thomas Fisher says the state believes ICTA applies only to economic regulations.
This is an area where, given the local safety considerations and the local traffic control considerations, it plainly falls within the ambit of a traditional area of state regulation.
The Indiana Supreme Court disagreed. The justices saw ICTA as having a broader scope and that the enforcement of the state statute would, in Chief Justice Loretta Rush's words, substantially interfere with railroad operations. So Fisher says it's up to the federal government.
A law that doesn't directly govern trains, but that protects public safety more generally, and a train happens to be involved, that's still an area where a state law can provide some relief. But trying to regulate trains directly, unfortunately, is not something that states are going to have any success doing.
Norfolk Southern contends that to follow the blocked crossing rule, the company may have to shorten or speed up trains. In an emailed statement, a company spokesperson says the railroad is, quote, very cognizant of the inconveniences that can result if a train is stopped too long. But the note also says the court's decision won't affect current work with local communities to resolve those issues, where they note Norfolk Southern employees live and work. Communities such as Frankfort, for example. Railroads are ingrained in the city's history, so much so that it named a new, much-publicized downtown housing project Nickel Plate Flats in honor of the old Nickel Plate Rail Line. But despite the rich rail history in Frankfort, Mayor Chris McBarnes says trains are one of his biggest problems.
You know, we're cut in half north and south on a daily basis when it comes to our rail. We have a hospital on one side, we have a retirement home on the other. We have fire stations on one side, we have residences on the other. We have police officers that get blocked and aren't able to make it to a call or backup officers.
That crossing is just west of a Norfolk Southern rail yard, and McBarnes says its location affects more than simply traffic.
It being so close to our industrial park and so close to the downtown, it has a negative impact on public safety and economic development, along with citizen convenience.
One of the big drivers of economic development in Frankfort is NHK Seating of America. The company makes car seats, which it sends to the large Subaru plant just up the road in Lafayette. NHK has two plants on one side of the tracks, its main facility on the other.
So when the railroad tracks are blocked, it can literally shut my production line down, usually within 20 to 30 minutes.
That's plant manager Richard Reck.
And it does happen on occasion, more often than we'd like to see.
So if drivers can't go through the crossing, maybe they could go over it. Or at least that's what Mayor McBarnes is hoping
for. The overpass itself would swing out a little further to the east.
He's talking about the local tracks program. It's a matching grant fund through the Indiana Department of Transportation designed to reduce the number of at-grade highway rail crossings and enhance safety at others. It's very competitive. NDOT received 28 applications, totaling about $370 million in requests. That's nearly three times what the state can award at the end of November. McBarnes hopes Frankfort's situation stands out. Norfolk Southern is also working with NDOT on the local tracks grant program, and while ripples of the Supreme Court's decision are felt around the Hoosier State, blocked crossings are holding up drivers all around the Midwest.
New at 6, trouble on the tracks, trains blocking railroad crossings in Ashtabula County.
A growing problem in Metro Detroit that's raising new safety concerns.
And now 5 on Your Side learns it is also happening in Highland.
But until the federal government decides to weigh in, which isn't a given, rural communities will search anywhere they can for a light at the end of the tunnel. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A Hebron mother is dedicating her life to getting justice for her son. Susan Jones, who was a registered nurse professionally, says her son Braxton was shaken by the boy's father. She says the child sustained permanent injuries and his life is now forever ruined. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Susan about how Braxton's life has been affected by what happened and about the current status of the case.
I was wanting to talk to you about what happened surrounding your son. Can you tell me when and where and what happened concerning your ex-husband and your son?
I will never, ever forget the date. It is always going to be stuck in my head. I was at work, working at the hospital overnight, midnight, and my son was shaken and abused severely by his father, my ex-husband, Curtis Jones, on July 24th of 2016.
How do you know this for sure? Did you see it happen? Is he a violent guy?
No, absolutely I did not see it happen. I was at work. I had left, I believe, 13 hours prior. So he had called me at work and told me the baby was stiff, as hard as a board. He was not opening his eyes. He was basically not conscious. He was cold, and he was gasping for air. And I just lost it. I said, why are you calling me? Call 911 right now. And he was rushed to one of our local hospitals. And I believe within, 45 minutes to an hour, once they stabilized him, intubated him, put him on life support, he was diagnosed with non-accidental abusive head trauma, which is also shaken baby syndrome. And then he was transferred to Lurie's Children's Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, and had emergency brain surgery. They removed the entire left side of his skull. I was there for 3.5 months with him. He was in a non-induced coma for 8 days. We made him a DNR. I had to meet with organ donations, hospice, and I was told my son would not live.
I am so sorry.
And we are almost 2.5 years post-injury now.
So what's Braxton like now? What's his health situation now?
He's going to be 3 in January. He has had 5 brain surgeries, several eye surgeries, other surgeries like for a feeding tube. He is extremely blind. He cannot sit up. He cannot talk. He cannot walk. He cannot take food by mouth. He doesn't have a whole lot of purposeful movement. They said the entire left side of his brain had died. His MRI is now, when you look at it, his brain has shrunken and it's basically just filled up with water. We go to Indy several times a week, 3 to 5 times a week for appointments and doing hyperbaric oxygen treatments, which is elective and all out of pocket. And I believe it's made a big difference. He's never going to be normal. We don't know what his life expectancy is. And it's just as bad as it gets. He should be going trick-or-treating here next week with his brother that's 17 months older, but unfortunately his father changed that for him.
Was Curtis ever charged?
He was charged 10 months after the injury. It took them 10 full months to charge him. We have yet to go to trial. It's been delayed. It is set again for January 15th for 5 days, and he's allowed to live out of state. He lives in Florida currently.
Is he a violent guy? Did he admit to doing it?
No, he did not admit to it. At first, he blamed the babysitter, which she is still my friend. We've been friends for, at least probably 18 years or longer. And then once he became the primary suspect, after day 12, I believe, post-injury, he was kind of like, well, maybe I should apologize to her. It's a misdiagnosis. My child was born completely healthy. And to get back to your question about is he a violent guy, no, I've never had any issues with him being violent. He was a great father to the kids. But I did notice that he was under a lot of stress probably a month prior before this happened, because he was in nursing school 6 weeks from graduating as an RN, and he was flunking his test and couldn't pass them. I did notice that he was just very stressed out. I really think that's what happened. I feel like he came home from his job that night and he tried to study for a test. I know for a fact that Braxton would always cry between 4 and 5 a.m. That's about the only time this kid would only cry, if he had a wet diaper or wanted to be fed. So, it makes completely sense to me why it happened at that time, because that's when he was the fussiest.
So you're sure that it was your husband and not the babysitter?
Absolutely. She was ruled out immediately.
So what did the people at the hospital say, and what did the police say?
People at the hospital have said it's court documented that it is literally the worst brain injury that Chicago Children's Hospital has ever seen. We're now seeking care at Riley. So between those two hospitals, I think my child has seen well over 50 doctors, you know, with all of their residents and all of his specialty doctors. And it's consistent that it is shaken baby syndrome. And I've had several of those doctors tell me it is the worst case they've ever seen, the worst brain injury, worst MRI they've ever seen. And the police said that after meeting with the doctors, that it happened on his time.
So has Curtis apologized for this or anything? Or
he has not. He flunked two lie detectors. He flunked one at the police station, a voice stress analyzer. And then he flunked one that his lawyer made him pay for. It was $1,400. He flunked that. They were hoping that he would pass it so they could wave it in the prosecutor's face, saying that he's innocent. No, he has not apologized. He has not done anything. He's several thousand dollars behind on child support.
What do you want to make happen in terms of justice for Brax?
I want him fully prosecuted. I think it is ridiculous that the same county that he worked for is handling the case. I think it should have been transferred. I requested it to be transferred. Several times. It's all documented with the state police and FBI. I don't think it's right that he is living in Florida until trial. And I think, you know, he's only looking at 16 years and he would have to serve 75% of that. And I don't think that's enough justice. I mean, he ruined this child's life. He completely destroyed him.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here is regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer.
We have another round of school referenda and more on the November 6th ballot. Get a perspective on the referenda as they're being reported on the ballots here, of course, locally here in Lake County and in other locations around the state. Let's turn to Larry DeBoer. He is a professor at Purdue University, a professor of economics at Purdue University down on the West Lafayette campus. And Larry, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Chris.
Well, we know that that a lot of the referenda questions have come up, and it's not just here in Lake County, although there is only one school referenda, but there are other referenda that questions that I guess are probably on the ballot elsewhere in the state of Indiana. I'll let you kind of run down the list here, and then we'll get into some of the background as to why these various organizations are asking for help from the voters.
Okay, well, there are 12 school referenda on the ballots across the state, and then one, the town of Highland Park District, up where you are, has a non-school referendum, and those are possible but are very rare. But 12 school referenda, and I can read you the list, but we've got them in Cannelton, down on the river in Perry County, Clark Pleasant School Corporation in Johnson, and Culver in Marshall, Hamilton Community Schools in DeKalb and Steuben. IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools, has two of them in Marion. Lake Ridge has got two of them up there in Lake County. Manchester Community in Wabash, Noblesville in Hamilton County, Prairie Heights in LaGrange, and Wanee Community School Corporation in Elkhart.
Yeah, they're all spread out across the state, aren't they?
They are, yes. Yeah. That's right.
And you mentioned the one there's one non-school referenda, and we know that's probably the one here in Lake County from the town of Highland. They're looking for approval from the voters to either, I guess, get into a lease agreement or into a bond issue of some type here to do work on the Lincoln Community Center in Highland.
That's right. You know, and when they passed the back in 2008, when the legislature said, hey, let's require referenda for capital projects, they said all capital projects of a certain size will be subject to referenda. And so I kind of expected that we'd see, you know, a dozen school and then half dozen county and city and town and park district and township referenda. But I think we've had fewer than 10 non-school referenda since 2008. So however they're doing it, the cities, towns, and counties are finding other ways to fund their infrastructure.
Do you get the impression, although I'm guessing it's not a last resort measure, but that for some in some cases, I'm sure it probably is, it may not be necessarily the case for the town of Highland. They probably could make some adjustments, but they would prefer to go to the voters, I would imagine, and ask for help, and especially in a project like a big community center that gets apparently a lot of use from the information we've gotten from the Parks and Rec Department in Highland.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that counties, cities, and towns can do is they can fund infrastructure with TIF districts, money from TIF, which schools can't do. And the TIF bonds are exempt from the referendum requirement. So I suspect that that's how an awful lot of infrastructure is being financed these days. But, you know, when you go to the voters and they vote yes, you can be pretty confident that this really is something that the people want. Yeah. And so it's a little surprising that we haven't seen more of that from the non-school units.
Well, I've noticed in the town of Highland that there are a lot of yes and no yard signs out there, and larger signs that have been put up by the yes delegation, so to speak, asking for support for the Lincoln Center project, to be sure. And maybe it's probably, although we brought this up in the past, time to remind our listeners, if they're not aware, about the reason that public school corporations ask for help from the voters through referenda, and that since they've been able to do so here in 2008. In fact, it's been the property tax reforms from 2008 that's really gotten things going, hasn't it?
Well, that's right. Until 2008, we had a petition remonstrance system, which was unique in the United States. And what it was basically competing petition drives. Whoever got the most signatures won as to whether a bond issue could be sold or not. But then they went, like 47 other states went to the referendum process. And so we've seen, let's see, I can look up the number right here. We have seen 73 capital projects referenda since 2008, and with the three this year, that'll make 76 altogether.
Wow.
So that was, you know, that's what authorized the thing. But at the very same time, and this was curious, and it didn't have to happen, all of a sudden we started seeing more tax referenda too, and those are for operating costs, and those were always possible. But prior to 2008, we saw maybe one referenda every other year. And since then, since 2008, we've seen a total of 103 with nine more this time. So 112 in the last 10 years. So all of a sudden, they became much more common. And it might be the property tax caps that subtracted some money from school corporations. It might be the fact that we eliminated the property tax for the general fund, and which means that schools now rely on state aid for their operating costs, and state aid, at least after the recession, grew rather slowly. Those could be some of the reasons. It may be also that the schools are looking out there and seeing, hey, a lot of schools are having success passing these things. Let's give it a try.
Yeah,
and that may be another reason.
Well, I know that there are individuals and organizations across the state that oftentimes counsel, in this case, school districts, because they're not exactly experts in how to approach their voters and their patrons to be able to get the support they need to be able to get these referenda passed. And I know that here in Lake County in particular, we've had organizations that have come in and kind of helped out as consultants, I guess, in a way, with the school superintendents and the school boards to be able to go out there and tell the right things to voters, to explain things properly so they are fully understandable about what the issues happen to be. And then a lot of cases, I know, not all, but I'm sure a lot of cases, that's when in turn has led to voters deciding that they'd go ahead with it.
I think that's probably one of the reasons. You know, when we first started this, from January through June of 2009, at that time you could hold a referendum any time. 12 were proposed in those 6 months in 2009, and 10 failed. And, of course, the recession was in full swing at that point, and that had to have something to do with it. But I also think that school corporations said, well, you know, we always just put these things out there, and they were hardly ever defeated in the petition remonstrance process, so we'll just put it out there. People vote yes, and we'll go ahead with it. And kind of a rude awakening. And I think that school corporations have learned that you got to run this thing like a campaign, And running like a campaign means bringing in professional campaign consultants to make sure it's run right. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we see is that a second time around, and I did a little test of this last after May, and found 16 referenda that had failed once, and then the same school corporation came back within 2 years and asked again. And 9 of those passed. And so from 0-16 to 9-7 tells me that experience counts. And I think one of the things that experience tells them is, boy, if we're going to do this, we better run this as a campaign.
I know you and your colleagues there in West Lafayette have gone through this extensively over the recent years, I know, and you've been able to actually break down school districts into categories, which have kind of broken down, which are logical, I suppose, urban, rural, and then a rural mixed. Where do a lot of these school corporations, especially this time around, seem to fit in?
Well, it's interesting. We've got really quite a mix this time. We've got three big ones. Of course, Indianapolis Public Schools is the second biggest school corporation in the state. Fort Wayne's actually a little bigger than they are now in total enrollment. They've got 28,000 students. Noblesville's got 10,000. And Clark Pleasant in Johnson County, southern part of the donut there, has got 6,500. So those are some of the biggest school corporations in the state. And then we've got three very small school corporations. We've got Culver with 779 students, Hamilton Community, and that's not Hamilton County, that's Hamilton Community Schools in DeKalb and Steuben up in the northeast Indiana, with 328, and then Cannelton down on the river in Perry County with 259 students altogether. So some very, very small school corporations and some very large ones as well. And then the rest of them are in the 1,000, 2,000 range.
Yeah, that's where Lake Ridge in Lake County comes into play there. They're small compared to the other school corporations in Lake County, to be sure. You know, communities like Griffith and Highland and Crown Point and others, Hammond, to be sure. But they're very, very, very small school. But they've I know, gone through an awful lot here, and we've kept track of them over the years. And they, like many others, have had to make some major cutbacks because of the 2008 tax caps. And I know that they're campaigning very hard this time around because they, and I'm sure that probably all of them, because they're on the ballot this time, are really, really worried about 2020. Explain what that deadline coming up is all about, and why school corporations that are really concerned about raising enough money are out there asking for help.
Yeah. Well, let me just point out Lake Ridge, at least my enrollment number I got here, they've got 1,873 students, which is small for Lake County, but is actually about the median for the state. So the rest of the state, 1,800, that's just typical. So what's the deal here? Back in 2010, when we voted the tax caps into the Constitution, the Constitution made exceptions for counties that met particular criteria, and the two counties that met those criteria were Lake and St. Joe. And what it did was to exempt existing debt service property tax payments, that is, property taxes that were raised in order to pay back borrowing. And so existing debt was exempted in Lake and St. Joe for 10 years. And the reason for that was that the caps were going to, let's say property taxes in St. Joe and Lake, property tax rates higher than the rest of the state. And so the tax caps, which kind of shave off the top, were going to really, really reduce. Well, they really did, but really reduce the revenues from the property tax in Lake and St. Joe. So they said, okay, we'll give you a break. You get 10 years to adjust this thing. I looked up Lake Ridge. It looks like about 98 cents of their property tax rate is exempt debt. And 2 years from now, that 10 years runs out. And so all of a sudden, all of the property tax rates, other than those passed by referendum, will be under the tax caps. And that means additional tax cap revenue losses for local governments. But one always has to turn around. It also means additional tax breaks for Lake County property taxpayers. Mm-hmm. But that's a revenue loss, and I'm pretty sure Lake Ridge looking ahead to that and saying, we'd better shore up our budget before that comes to pass.
They have talked about that, and we've had the chance to talk with the superintendent here on the program in more detail about the issues. And like I said, we know that going back a few years, they've had to close schools, make some major cutbacks in operations and expenses to try to deal with the situation then. And they are very, very, very concerned about what will happen come 2020 when the tax caps kick in full force, I suppose, in particular with the debt service. You had a chance, I know, in our conversation ahead of time, talking about how Lake Ridge and other school corporations fit in to what they're asking their taxpayers and their particular school districts to pay if they approve a referenda. How do things stand with Lake Ridge School Corporation here in Lake County?
Well, Lake Ridge is asking for two referenda, the building construction renovation capital projects referenda, which is $44 million they're asking for, is going to take a tax rate of $1.12, and that's $1.12 per $100 of taxable assessed value. Mm-hmm. And the operating referendum, in addition, adds a dollar. So altogether, that's $2.12. Either one of those would be the highest tax rate ever asked for in a referendum since 2008. The previous high was about 87 cents in Oak Hill back in 2011. We're going to get a good test here as to how much rates matter in results. You know, as an economist, I tend to like to think that, or I'm conditioned to think that the higher is the price, the less people will do. And it is true that really low rates, when they are asked, 15 cents, 20 cents, that sort of thing, do tend to pass more frequently. But as you move above that, it doesn't seem to make that much difference. Well, $1 rate and then two $1 rates, that's way above the 20, 25 cent range. And so I guess we'll see how much difference that can make.
And we know in the future that there will be other school corporations that will probably be asking for help from their voters, too. We've had some inkling, at least a threat in one case, I guess, by one of the Gary Community School Corporation board members that the Gary Community Schools may have to go back again. They had an effort seeking help from the voters, which failed. And they're going to make another referendum attempt, I'm sure, probably in the next few years to try to get caught up. That's a special situation, we know, with the Gary Community School Corporation, since they are one of the two that are under state takeover right now. And in fact, even the school board members, and recall from the stories that we've had, mentioned about the fact that it'll probably be members of the administration, the takeover administration in this case, who the school board member said are not residents of Gary. So we'll see what happens there too. So will we probably continue to see more school corporations take on, maybe not as much as what Lake Ridge is asking for, but other corporations asking for help?
Well, that's possible. One should point out about Lake Ridge is that if you take a look at their assessed value per pupil, which is kind of a measure of their ability to tax, or a comparison of their tax base to their service requirements, it's one of the lowest in the state. And so if they want to raise any kind of money at all, they're going to need a higher tax rate. And I think that's one reason why you see those dollar rates that they're asking for. I think it matters a lot. For example, Indianapolis Public Schools is asking for $52 million, which is a little more than Lake Ridge, but they're doing it on 3 cents. And of course, they've got a much, much bigger assessed value base than Lake Ridge does. Perhaps we'll see bigger rates asked, but I don't see a trend for that. And a lot of it just depends on how much property have you got to tax. You got a lot of property to tax. You don't need a very big rate in order to raise sufficient funds.
Well, Larry, thank you for your insight and your analysis of all of this. You and your colleagues there at Purdue University in West Lafayette working on this, really appreciate it. And we'll probably get back with you here to do a post-mortem talking about what may have come out with these other referenda around the state, including here in Lake County. Thanks for being with us today to talk about it.
Hi, welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Larry DeBoer is a professor in economics at Purdue University in West Lafayette.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.